You are listening to Heartbeat of Humanity, a podcast series for staff and volunteers in the Red Cross and Red Crescent movement, working with mental health and psychosocial support services. My name is Sarah Harrison, Technical Advisor on Mental Health and Psychosocial Support for the IFRC Reference Centre for Psychosocial Support. In this first episode of the new year, we will be speaking with Dr. Peter Ventervogel, UNHCR's Senior Mental Health and Psychosocial Support Officer, and we'll be discussing the links between protection and mental health and psychosocial support. Thank you for joining us today, Peter, and thank you for your time as well.
Thank you for having me, Sarah.
You and I recently wrote an article for the publication Forced Migration Review that will be coming out in March. What was the motivation or what stimulated us to write the MHPSS and protection policy piece?
Well, actually, I would say it was to further encourage the engagement of protection staff with MHPSS. So it was, for me, the driving force was to advocate within protection. And that may sound a bit strange, or it may sound as if nothing happens, which is not true. I think the world of mental health and psychosocial support has gone through an enormous growth, and we see many things happening everywhere, including in protection. But if you look closer, what you see is that it's not an even development. It's in some parts of protection, there is a very strong engagement with mental health and psychosocial support, particularly in child protection and in GBV. Very strong methodologies, very clear attention for mental health and psychosocial support in their work. But protection is much broader. And the other, let's say, the other parts of protection, some of them do wonderful work, but it's not very coherent. And I think there are chances to do more. And it doesn't really have to mean that we need an awful lot of money and resources, but it also is about having MHPSS on your lens if you are working in protection. That's how I would say it. I don't know how you see it.
It is the same. I think it's a reality from IFRC side as well. We're not going to get necessarily an increase in volunteers or in manpower or people power to do additional programming. It's much more about how we can get existing staff and volunteers to be able to take on MHPSS or integrate and have an awareness of MHPSS within their work, even if they are protection profiled staff, and vice versa. It's also about people within an MHPSS background or training also being aware of the link with protection and how it fits.
That's true, because that is also important, what MHPSS actors can contribute to protection work and how they can actually also foster MHPSS work within protection. No, I agree. But it is slightly also driven by a certain concern, which I would like to mention here as well, this piece, at least for me. And that is that I think the attention for some people with clear protection risks and clear risks for mental health and psychosocial problems, GBV survivors, what we know the link between sexual and gender-based violence and mental health problems is very clear, it must be addressed. Yeah. Children are, of course, also a group that are vulnerable. We don't like the word vulnerable, but they have a clear increased risk. But what if you are not one of those specific groups? What if you are a man, or what if you are a survivor of other forms of violence? Torture survivors is another group. And I think it would be good if that would come out a bit more clear. Mental health and psychosocial well-being of older people is another issue.
Yeah,
it's not that nothing is happening, but I think it would be good if it's clearly on the lens of people who are coordinating or implementing protection work.
Yeah, and we mention in the article also about the four protection principles in the SPHERE handbook, and I know that you were also helping co-draft the health. The mental health standard within the broader health chapter, but also looking within the handbook at the link also between mental health and psychosocial support and protection. And I think one of the principles actually covers this.
You're totally right. One of the four protection principles is actually about the psychological consequences of violence and other human rights abuses. And so I think the rationale for protection actors to engage with MHPSS is there. But it's now, I think many people working in protection just may not feel comfortable to really do much because some may think like it's a bit for specialists or so. You need,
yeah.
It's maybe not for us. And I think it's important to demystify mental health and psychosocial support, because no matter what kind of background you have, if you are helping people to overcome their problems or their human rights violations or their protection risks, then you can very easily also do things to improve their mental health and psychosocial well-being. I think you always do that, actually, but it's also a matter of, in UNHCR, we have this distinction that we try to foster between an MHPSS intervention, something that you do really with the primary goal to improve psychosocial well-being or mental health, or using an MHPSS approach. So you have perhaps another primary goal, could be anything, could be legal protection, could be registration, but in you doing your work, you have an effect on well-being of the people you work with.
Yes. And that's the same for refugee operations as it is with your work with IDPs and other groups, stateless, for example.
For this piece, actually, absolutely, because the of course UNHCR is often seen as very active in refugee situations, but UNHCR also works particularly in protection in internally displaced situations, and I think that would be good. I mean, it's sometimes very practical that if you have UNHCR often has the mandate or has the mandate and the lead in protection coordination in IDP settings.
Yes,
and I think it would be good if, for example, MHPSS would be a standing point on the agenda of protection meetings.
Yes.
Just that you just think about it. What can we do? Do we have resources?
Yeah. From the IFRC and the Red Cross, Red Crescent movement perspective, we, in our new policy that we have on mental health and psychosocial support, we actually say that the foundation of helping people with mental health and psychosocial support needs is a protective external environment. And that's linked to both legal protection in terms of international human rights law, Geneva Conventions, and refugee law. But we're looking particularly at people with specific mental health conditions and people in psychological distress who are usually discriminated against, or if they're not discriminated against, their very condition is a limiting factor or an inhibiting factor for them to access services. So not wanting to go outside of their shelter or their house to access a service, or the perceived discrimination that comes with it.
I like the way you formulate it, because I think if you formulate it as also a protective environment, that is so important, then you also make clear that it is not just an intra-psychic intervention. It's not just about changing the mind or the emotions within a person, which you could say you need some training or specialization in it, but it also is about the environment. Actually, it is about the context, and there of course many people can actually make the context better, safer, and more make it more possible for people to protect themselves.
Yeah, I think similar to how UNHCR has it when you talked about the NMHPSS approach. So so it's more the mainstreaming work. We would have it from IFRC perspective, we would also say it's about providing the principled assistance. So assistance and services that appreciate someone's dignity, reinforce their access to rights,
right,
empower them, that type of, which is very much the same as the MHPSS approach.
Yes. And it also is very much, of course, good humanitarian practice, or it should be. Very much related to protection mainstreaming and all those general principles. I mean, many of the things are the same, but I think it's good to just mention this MHPSS specifically.
It's part of it, And I think concretely, examples from our side of programming would be, for example, Restoring Family Links program. That's looking at reuniting families separated by a conflict or by another disaster, it could be, where you have protection colleagues working on the literal family tracing aspect. And you don't need to be a child. You can also be an adult needing to trace your family, or even a refugee and a migrant coming to a country and wanting to have links back to their family again. And it's about protection profiled staff and volunteers working on the family tracing, also having an understanding of MHPSS. And it might also be that they're paired with an MHPSS volunteer who can also accompany that person. And we also see it a bit in detention facilities as well, where we have volunteers and staff visiting detention facilities as per our mandate. That's a protection activity. But it's the person who's sitting in front of a detainee needs to have an understanding of how to do the active listening, how to do the sensitive communication, and how
to manage. That's a brilliant example, because I don't think you will have a mental health professional, be able to have a mental health professional to go to each detention facility. But you, as the Red Cross, Red Crescent movement, is sending people to these detention facilities, and then if those people have some attention for mental health, that's great.
Yeah, and practically speaking, in terms of the refugee operations and for UNHCR, who are your counterparts? For example, do you have MHPSS officers in countries, or who do you work with?
For the refugee operations, well, yes, but UNHCR tries to be as lean as possible. So many of the implementation activities, particularly in the technical sectors, of course, in health and in WASH and in education, are done by our partners that we sometimes fund or sometimes in support in other ways.
Yeah.
For protection, we do a bit more ourselves sometimes, but also we work with partners. So we don't have that many. We don't have like hundreds of MHPSS officers in the field. We have a few. I think I would say we are around 5-6 now. So it's little. But I see the role of UNHCR not so much as doing everything, but as making sure things are being done and not overlooked. Yeah. So I would think that it's important that protection officers in UNHCR have a good understanding of what MHPSS is. So we recently have a document on strengthening MHPSS in 2021 in UNHCR that very specifically also asks protection officers to work with MHPSS. And I think one important part of that work would be when you work with community volunteers. Community volunteers in community-based protection.
Yeah.
That you train them also in active listening, in basic psychosocial skills, perhaps also in identifying people who really need more specific support and then refer. So, and I think that's something that's not very difficult to do, and it's happening in many countries. I know good examples from our work with refugees in Iraq and in Bangladesh, where this is just staple work, but it's not yet everywhere. So that's something I think that's important, but it's going to all aspects of protection. For example, something that UNHCR is strongly involved in, refugee status determination. So just seeing whether a person is a refugee or not. In many places, UNHCR does that or supports governments to do it. Now that's a tough job, because sometimes people have to tell what really happened, and it's very strong emotions are sometimes coming up in those interviews. So one of the things we've now done is we have renewed the guidance on working with applicants with mental health conditions in refugee status determination.
So important.
Yeah, and our colleagues in Australia, UNHCR Australia, have worked with the government to actually do trainings and workshops for refugee status determination staff. Mm. So those are some examples. But also in everything, for example, another thing is, for example, when you have voluntary repatriation, fortunately, that still happens. So sometimes if a crisis is over, people can return. But that's a lot of stress also if you do that, and people need to be followed. So now an example, for example, in Angola, when refugees from DRC went back last year, is that the protection monitoring explicitly the people were trained in MHPSS, and also there was a kind of standby partner that if a person would really get very distressed that they would be consulted. So those are it's not always very difficult to do it, but it's just it should be on your radar.
And the community-based protection officers that you mentioned, they're the previous community services?
Yes, we've gone through a change in the last 5 to 10 years from community services, which sometimes has a little bit the idea of we provide services for people, to a community-based protection. So it is more an enabling function. What can we do with communities to make sure that rights are respected and people can support themselves?
Yeah, and in terms of the health programming, because you also do a lot of work with the health side. You have partners that are also delivering health services if you're not doing it directly in camps and outside of camps. Is there any activities that UNHCR does with the health staff?
Oh yes, that's my day to day work, of course. So that means so that I can talk for hours. So that's like basically we think and I've been saying that now for 8 years, and I'm fortunate to say that actually people all believe it now, that you cannot have a primary healthcare program for refugees without a mental health component. I mean, that's it.
Okay.
So that means that you need to train health professionals in mental health. We have tools for that, the MHGAP tools developed by WHO and UNHCR for humanitarian settings. So we've trained over 1,000 people over the last 5 years in mainly sub-Saharan Africa in this methodology.
Yeah.
But also that you need to make mental health specialists available where possible, particularly in, for example, operations or where you have more than 25,000 refugees, so it's a significant population.
Yes.
You need to have a mental health professional who visits those places to see people with more severe mental health issues or complex complex problems. And sometimes it's possible to deploy a psychiatric nurse, for example, in Uganda. That happens in most of the places. In other places like Eastern Chad, this is not possible. So you have to do it another way. So you train the available generalists through these MHGAP trainings.
But we also it's usually a national person, right? Or is it, it's always a national person?
This is actually almost always a national person. Yep. Because I think when it comes to delivering health services, there is a little added value of a foreigner doing it. Even in terms of licensing, it's difficult. Mm. No, this is almost always national staff.
Okay. Yep.
And sometimes it's the government itself. We support the government to do that.
Yeah, to do it as well.
But it's also about your health information system, because in many health information systems in health centers, the categories to classify a person with a mental health problem are not well delineated. So we have adapted our health information system so that we can properly register and document it. We also have actually always psychotropic drugs in our drug orders when we do
in your supply chains.
Yeah. And the exciting part for me is that in the last years, we tried to introduce scalable psychological interventions within health centers. That's still at the beginning, but brief psychological interventions such as Problem Management Plus or interpersonal therapy for depression. So we are now introducing that. I think we had it in about 6, 7, 8 countries now.
Okay.
We're starting doing it. The coverage is still limited because it takes time to build capacity. But but that's something I really think should be increased in the next years.
Yeah. And in terms of if you came across someone who was a torture survivor, whether that person's a refugee or even if it's in an IDP operation where UNHCR still has the mandate to do the coordination aspect, how do you see the link then between a person presenting at a health service that might have had that experience, might have been tortured, in terms of what you are equipping or what you would like your partners to be able to provide to that person?
It's a difficult one because I think we have a long way to go here, to be very honest. We have a long way to go. It's, of course, a matter of safe disclosure. Eh? I think we can learn a lot from GBV.
Yeah.
It's about safe disclosure, not asking questions in a very intrusive way, but be very, very aware of the fact that the person may be tortured. And we've come a long way for GBV, with mandatory trainings of health staff about these aspects. But I think we have to do more when it comes to other human rights violations.
Because certainly the GBV, the Clinical Management of Rape package, I know that WHO and others are looking to make it much more sensitive towards mental health and psychosocial support to better integrate it, because it's not really as well as integrated as it could be. I think it's much more of a clinical, biological, medical focus.
Absolutely.
I agree. I think that we're further behind with survivors of torture and other human rights violations as well.
Yes. It's a bit of a dilemma, because we don't have the resources, neither it would be a good idea to have separate categorical services for torture survivors because of the stigma that you very easily then create. On the other hand, it is tough to work with torture survivors. I've done it when I was still working as a psychiatrist in the Netherlands, and it really is tough. So in some places, we work with partners who have good experience with that. The Center for Victims of Torture is a partner of UNHCR in Jordan, for example, but also in African countries like in Ethiopia, Uganda, Kenya. They do fantastic work, but they often come with their own funding as well. Something, it's not part of our standard package yet, unfortunately, but fortunately we have great partners like this that do this.
It's the same from the Red Cross perspective. We have a number of national societies that run torture treatments or torture survivor centers, but they again have separate funding, and it requires a lot of manpower and usually supported by government, so ministries of health type funding or migration ministry funding. But it also requires a longer term accompaniment aspect as well, which isn't so possible if it's a sudden onset or a natural disaster type emergency as well. And you mentioned that in 2021 that there was new guidelines. Is it coming out for UNHCR?
Yeah, just came out this week, so you probably haven't seen it yet. So it's not a guideline, it's a document that has been agreed with the regional bureaus of UNHCR about what are points we need to strengthen, and we try to be as concrete as possible. So we for example, we have commitments. So one commitment is to introduce scalable psychological interventions in 3 new countries, or to develop suicide prevention plans in at least 3 country operations of UNHCR. And so we try to make it as concrete as possible, and I'm quite hopeful. But of course, everything is dependent on the total context, about how much funding do we get, how many new emergencies will develop. So what can we do?
A lot of external factors, to weigh in. But was this new document a product or an outcome from the previous work that we'd done on the Think piece, and also at the Global Protection Cluster, we had the forum where we had a particular session on MHPSS? I'm in relation
it's related to that because it became increasingly clear for well, the interesting thing is that now senior policymakers were asking for it. This piece that I now make was actually asked by the High Commissioner for Refugees, who just said,
"Okay, chapeau. Yeah, that's
what are we doing? What are we doing with MHPSS, and what can we? How can we strengthen it?"
Okay.
And let's not be over. I mean, I'm optimistic, but let's not be over optimistic because it's tough. Eh? If you see under-resourced country operations, and you will have that in IFRC as well, that you have countries that really have limited resources, and we ask them all the time to do more. So we have to pick our battles. So really, ask them to do the things that we think, make the biggest difference.
Yeah, and where it's possible.
Yes.
Because it's, I think a global rollout is just not feasible.
No.
For this. We need to pick the opportunities as they come.
Yeah. But in principle, I really hope that to come back to that article in Forced Migration Review, is that it really helps in very practical ways to put MHPSS on the agenda of all protection actors. And sometimes literally putting it on the agenda of protection coordination meetings, but also in terms of training staff. Eh? We have protection monitoring teams. You can easily train them 1 day, 2 days in MHPSS. Yeah. It's about referral pathways. It's about, it's about all those aspects.
Yeah.
So I'm hopeful. I don't know how you see it.
No, I am hopeful as well. I'm a cautious optimist like yourself, I think.
Yes.
I think the same way that we've become a bit closer in terms of integrating mental health services under primary healthcare or even secondary healthcare in some countries, we need to do the same with protection actors.
Absolutely.
And it's a different language that they speak. It's demystifying our terminology we've made up.
Yes.
On the MHPSS side. I think that we're not going to be able to have this separate pillar of MHPSS.
That's right.
In most organizations, that just isn't feasible.
No. I'm also, there is one development I may mention, and that is the development of the minimum services package MHPSS by the World Health Organization, UNICEF and UNHCR, which initially the idea was to focus on health and child protection and MHPSS, because those are areas where actually there is low-hanging fruit, a lot of methodologies already. But in the course of the development of the tool, we got feedback. People said, no, you need to also to work on general protection, you need to work on education, you need to work on GBV. So those aspects are now being included. Mm. And so it will be also a document that's useful for people working in protection and GBV.
Will it also include things like inclusion or addressing stigmatization?
It will, well, we're still working on the document, so still consulting people, but it will, it should be actionable items. Eh? So it's not like a conceptual guidance. It should be actionable
concrete,
things.
Yeah.
But I think when it comes to actions to include emergency affected populations to national services, that's always something that's high on our level, on our mind, of course.
Mm.
So inclusion is there, but it's mainly focusing on the what to do. So the
actions. Okay, and then it's costed as well, I understand.
Yes, it's costed. So so that it's more, you get a more predictable response. So that when we now see that a lot of progress has been made in MHPSS, that's how I started the discussion, but we also see it's uneven. So there are still places where there is very little services. So we hope that there will be more equity when you have a package like this.
Yeah, and again, supporting the under-resourced operations wherever they are, or countries that are struggling for funding.
Exactly,
as well. Okay. Well, thank you for speaking with us.
It's always a pleasure.
You've been listening to The Heartbeat of Humanity, a podcast series for Red Cross, Red Crescent Movement staff and volunteers about mental health and psychosocial support. In this episode, we explored the links between protection and mental health and psychosocial support with Dr. Peter Ventervoekel from UNHCR. You can find more resources about mental health and psychosocial support on the IFRC Psychosocial Centre website. Resources include manuals, webinars, policy documents, programme materials, educational videos, and information about upcoming trainings. My name is Sarah Harrison, and I hope you enjoyed listening to this Heartbeat of Humanity podcast. Remember that mental health matters.